The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Jason Freeman. I'm pleased to join you here to introduce tonight's guest, Drew Gilpin Faust, the Arthur Kingsley Porter University Professor at Harvard University and its president from 2007 to 2018. She formerly served as Dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and taught at the University of Pennsylvania for 25 years. Her many books include This Republic of Suffering, Death and the American Civil War, winner of the Bancroft Prize and a finalist for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. She's also the author of Mothers of Invention, Women of the Slaveholding South in the American Civil War, winner of the Frances Parkman Prize. She joins us tonight with her latest book, Necessary Trouble, Growing Up at Mid-Century, a post-war coming-of-age memoir about life in a conservative family in segregated Virginia. It is an account of her break from the racial and gender norms of the era and the means by which her involvement in the civil rights and anti-war movements led to her career as an historian of those very fights. A review in the Washington Post reads, Faust has gone back to a foreign country, America, when post-1945 conventions and complacencies began to crumble, and has returned with a needed gift for today's nation, an example of mature assessment. Amen. Tonight's guest will be joined in conversation with Reverend Dr. Jonathan Lee Walton. He is the president of the Princeton Theological Seminary, and he is the author of Watch This, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Black Televangelism, and the author of A Lens of Love, Reading the Bible in Its World for Our World. His other work has appeared across a range of media, including The New York Times, CNN, Time Magazine, and PBS. So, Philly, won't you please join me in welcoming tonight's guests to the Free Library.
Good evening.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
It is such a pleasure to be here with you tonight.
It is my great pleasure. Let me tell you all that Jonathan is going to be officially inaugurated as president of the Princeton Theological Seminary on Friday. So the fact that he is here tonight is something I'm hugely grateful for. And we worked together for 7 years at Harvard, so I am very much in his debt to have been able to extract this token of friendship in his presence tonight. So thank you, Jonathan.
We worked together. You know, she was my boss. But I am so excited to be here to discuss this extraordinary memoir. You are an incredible historian, incredible writer. It's just so absolutely engaging. And I actually want to begin tonight's conversation where you end, talking about the title of the book. We know that the title, Necessary Trouble, comes from the late congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis, his great line, "We must make good trouble, necessary trouble." You discuss how you were had a relationship, your professional colleagues, and you discussed that. But I know that your relationship, you looked at him more than just for as a professional mentor. He was really an inspiration to you. I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your relationship with John Lewis over the years and how that informed this book and ultimately the title.
It's a pleasure to do so. I first became aware of John Lewis when I was becoming aware of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and in particular when he had his head bashed in on the bridge in Selma, which was a kind of transformative moment for me when I watched that on television and thought, this can't be America. This can't be who we are. if I don't do something about this now, how will I ever live with myself? So I write in the book about being inspired by that sense and by his sacrifice to go to Selma and cut my midterm exams out at Bryn Mawr College and get into various kinds of trouble, which I think were good trouble. I then met him, actually, for the first time to really interact with him when I was giving a talk for the National Endowment for the Humanities, and he was asked to get up and read a poem in advance of my talk. And so I got to speak with him, and it happened to be the 50th anniversary of the day he left Washington on the Freedom Rides that, again, led to his head being bashed in. So it seemed just so extraordinary to be with him on that anniversary. And then he very graciously agreed to come and speak at Harvard on various occasions, but one in particular that was extremely meaningful to me and I think to him, which is we had discovered that there had been 4 enslaved people living in the president's house in the 18th century. Maybe more, but we were able to find names of at least 4. And so we put up a plaque naming these enslaved people and remembering their stolen lives and trying to underscore the humanity of these people who had been more or less erased from history. And John Lewis came to speak at that dedication in an extraordinarily unforgettable and moving way. And then he again spoke at my final commencement as president of Harvard, and when he gave his opening remarks for his speech, he turned to me and said, "Madam President, thank you for making necessary trouble." And that phrase had been very much in my mind because it seemed to me to capture a lot of what I wanted to write about in this book, which was I was, in the view of my family and those in my community, always causing trouble by challenging who I was supposed to be and how I was supposed to behave and what the mores of our society were. My father once said to me, "Why be difficult when you can be impossible?" That kind of captures my relationship with my family. So I was seen as a troublemaker, but for me this trouble was necessary to survive. I felt that I could not have been a full human being, I could not have lived a satisfying life if I hadn't made that trouble. And so I called Congressman Lewis just a couple of months before he died, and I asked if it would be okay if I named the book that I was working on, Necessary Trouble. And he said so gracious always, he said he would be honored, he would be more than happy for me to do that. And so I felt that I was justified or had his blessing in choosing this title for the book. And I hope he would feel good about the book that came out. I don't know. He died long before the book was ever done. But I'm just very proud to have been given his permission to give it this title.
Speaking of necessary trouble, your life growing up, mid-century America, being difficult, being impossible. Your life traversed the boundaries of class and culture and region, like your parents on so many different levels. And one of the things that comes through in the book is the ways that the rituals that you say that you learned how to enact from a very young age, what it means to be a girl, what it means to be white, right? Can you talk about some of those rituals and then your own awareness or coming of, because at 9 years old, writing the President of the United States, writing Eisenhower, and identifying yourself as a young white girl, that's not common.
Well, maybe it was always the sense of contrast that I was asked to do things as a child that were meant to prepare me to be a lady in Virginia. But I had 3 brothers who were not asked or required, is a better word, actually. I wasn't asked, I was told, that I would wear certain kinds of frilly underwear, and I would be decorous, and I would wear a skirt to dinner. I would curtsy. I would not be able to do certain other things that my brothers were able to do. And so I saw a very sharp gender divide between who I was and who they were and who I was going to grow up to be, which was inevitably someone who did not work outside the home, someone who had to be devoted to children and husband the way my mother and all those of her women of her social circle were. And I think I similarly increasingly saw what it meant to be white and what it meant to be black. At first, I just knew it was a difference that black people used one bathroom in our house, the people who worked for my parents, and we weren't supposed to use that bathroom, but we used other bathrooms. They ate in the kitchen. We did not disturb them when they were doing that. And my mother always cast that as being respectful, but what it was segregating. And there were deep ideologies beneath it that I had no inkling of at a young age. But I knew that there were these divisions. And then one day when I was 9 years old and I was driving home from school, being driven home from school by an African-American man who worked for my parents, I heard on the radio discussion of Virginia's resistance to Brown v. Board. In the aftermath of the Brown v. Board decision in 1954 mandating integration of public schools, Virginia devised an approach which was called massive resistance, close the schools rather than integrate them. And this caused a lot of turmoil and discussion, and this was what was coming onto the radio and kind of making overt a lot of what previously had simply been assumed and embodied through rituals, as you suggested. And I had this awakening where I suddenly realized that I went to a school that was all white, not by accident, but by design and by law. And so I asked the African-American man driving me, if I painted my face black, I couldn't go to my school anymore. Black people can't come to my school. Your daughter couldn't come to my school. And he said, not a word, which only reinforced my sense that what I was saying was absolutely true. So I began to see that these differences of white and black, of which I'd been aware, were differences of injustice. And that sent me home to write in a rage to Eisenhower. And I think I was so mad, not just because it was an injustice, but because I had been sold a bill of goods. I'd been told about Christianity, I'd been told about American democratic ideals, and suddenly it turns out that everybody is doing something completely at odds with the values that they are teaching me. And so that kind of put a spanner in the works, I guess, and led me to say, I'm 9 years old and I'm white. And this is what I think, President Eisenhower. There are parts in this letter, I have to say, they're hilarious. I don't know if you think they're funny, but there's one point where I say to the president, as you know, President Eisenhower, Christ was born on Christmas Day. It's like, okay. You know, I'm sort of telling off the president here with
good
my
trouble.
Vast...
Necessary trouble.
My vast 9-year-old knowledge. Anyway.
So these are... What you were describing, these are clearly cultural scripts of the southern region. Right? How did these scripts become more confusing or maybe illuminating when you went to New England, to Concord Academy?
So when I was just short of my 13th birthday, I went off to Concord Academy as a boarding student, and it was an all-girls school where girls' minds were taken very seriously. We were challenged intellectually. It was a world run by women. There were a few male teachers, but basically this group of very powerful women, including one extremely powerful one, Elizabeth Hall, ran the place. And they challenged us to do whatever we could to embellish our minds and our characters, and they took us really seriously. And that was in some contrast to how I'd been treated in school in the South. I'd always been encouraged, but I came across, in writing this book, I went through all these piles of stuff from my family that had been deposited on me for various reasons. I found my second grade report card, where my second grade headmaster tells me that I shouldn't read so many books the next summer. Okay. Because enough is enough. I read too many last summer. Shouldn't read so many this summer. Now, this was not the stuff of Concord Academy. You know, I was in a different world. I mean, we might say it was the 19th century blue stocking world. It was not entirely a liberated world for women, but the little world itself was a bubble of female opportunity and female power. And so that was a real contrast. But there was a kind of odd set of contradictions and ironies. This was also an entirely white world when I landed there. The school began to be integrated by the time I left, but only just. However, the values that were embraced were very much in sympathy with the emerging civil rights movement. We read books that opened us to knowledge about race in America. And as Jonathan and I were just discussing, I had an extraordinary opportunity when I was a junior to visit a neighboring school where Martin Luther King was giving a talk. And so off I went, along with other Concord Academy students who wished to join in, to hear Martin Luther King give a kind of prequel to his March on Washington, I Have a Dream address, in February of 1963. So the reality of Concord in terms of race and the ideals that were embraced were so distant that you could call it rank hypocrisy, but it didn't seem so, because I think everybody wanted to move in the right direction. They just didn't quite know how to get there.
And it seems King really pushed the audience that night on that topic.
He did. Now, some miscreant student at Groton secretly recorded the speech. And so there's actually a transcript of this amazing speech that King gave on that night. There weren't supposed to be any recordings of it, but this emerged 40 years later. And King says, America is built on a dream. That's how he begins the speech. But then he challenges the people in New England for their complacency. He said, this is not just something happening. These injustices aren't just in Georgia or the South. They're all over the country. And you people of goodwill must abandon their appalling silence, I think is the word he uses, the phrase he uses, their appalling silence if they are to be ethical people. And so for a young person hearing that about my appalling silence, it was certainly reinforcing of abandoning that appalling silence and trying to live up to the ideals that he had put out before us.
So the world shifts in terms of opportunities, educational opportunities, possibilities. You write on page 112, discussions of women changing lives in the second half of the 20th century often invoke the notion of role models, who have attained positions of power and influence. As a young child, I encountered no such living models. No female politicians, writers, artists, scientists. My role models had to come from the world of books. As such an incredible historian, what you lay bare when it comes to gender, racial, other forms of discrimination, this is kind of quotidian contours of daily life of mid-century. I was wondering if you could speak to that, particularly across generations, for those who say, things just aren't getting any better.
So one of the biggest motivations for me in writing this book is I felt that young people, and alas, there aren't too many of them in this audience, but maybe you could go tell all the young people you know, that a lot of young people don't understand how awful the 50s were. And that what Jonathan just called the quotidian realities of discrimination, of language that today would be labeled as microaggression, the pervasiveness of just horrifying sets of assumptions and constraints on women and African Americans in particular, but I think constraints that reverberated well beyond their impact on black people and women. So I wanted to just trace and describe some of those constraints to give a picture of what that world looked like from inside, from the eyes of a person trying to find her way through it, trying to make choices within those structures and within those opportunities or lack thereof. And so one of the ways I did this, I found a lot of approaches to try to do it, but One of my favorite ones actually was going back and reading all of Life magazine from the 1950s, because I wanted to understand how I saw the wider world. I lived on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and yet I was passionately concerned about the Hungarian Revolution. I don't know where that came from. Life magazine, I decided. A lot of my evolving views about race came from the extraordinary treatment of race in Life magazine. There's a series that appears beginning in 1956 about the history of segregation that would be banned today in many states of our country that are trying to eliminate anything uncomfortable in our history from the curriculum. There are the issue has a picture of an enslaved woman on an auction block being sold on the cover. Inside, there are photographs of people being tortured and shot, and it's just an extraordinarily vivid and horrifying portrait of race in America in the 19th century. That was eye-opening. But also eye-opening was stuff about women, where the ads for women's underwear, the kind of constraints. Does anyone remember what a merry widow is? We got it? Okay. A merry widow is like a bra that goes from your neck to your waist, where it meets your girdle, which then goes down almost to your knees, so that your entire body is encased and protected, I assume, but also distorted in ways that are, I think, unimaginable to young people today. Some of the things that were said about what women should do or not do when Life had an issue, 70 pages of which were devoted to women. All these letters come into Life saying, why'd you waste that much of the issue talking about women? Women's issues aren't of concern. And then there are wonderful things like food. How about national wrap up your leftovers in a Jell-O salad week? That's a good one. Or how about women smoking during labor and delivery? There are photographs of that. And so just this is a foreign country that I want young people to know about. I want them to know about the curiosities of it, but the unimaginable oppressions that were just taken for granted as part of everyday life.
You touched on something about parts of life, those stories that would possibly be banned in parts of our country today.
Mm-hmm. Right?
I grew up in a faith tradition that taught education was sacred. Right? If you want to change the world, read. Education, the keys to liberation. And we know that this is why, for much of our nation's history, people of color, women, right, not taken seriously as co-laborers in the world of ideas. Right? Mm-hmm. You even heard that growing up. As a historian, how do you assess this kind of resurgence of book bans and of silencing history and not trying to, or trying to keep white children from being uncomfortable? How do you assess that as a historian that we're here now?
Well, I'm appalled by it. I think it is against education as anything other than training for a slot into which you are to be slotted. It doesn't open up the human capacity. It doesn't open up a child or a young person to a world. It narrows the world rather than expanding it. I quote the person who was head of Concord Academy who said, dare to be uncomfortable. That's what education was about. Education by definition was uncomfortable because you needed to stretch. You needed to like use muscles that aren't yet ready, and so they hurt the way they do when you take up running, except you're taking up thinking, and you're taking up asking questions in ways that disturb everything that you are, maybe land you right back where you started, stronger, because you've asked yourself why you wanted to be there. But maybe it lands you somewhere completely different, and that's the point. I used to want to say to Harvard parents, I promise to give you back a child different from the one you're leaving off here. And then I realized that some parents didn't want to hear that. But I think we ought to promise that in education. That's what it should be about. It should be about change, and it should be about growth, and it should not be about simply reinforcing what's already in your head and narrowing a world rather than expanding it.
Parents not wanting those kids back, that's reflective of intergenerational tension that we know that happens, particularly around change in American society. As a historian, as a professor, someone who engages young people on a daily basis, right? What is it that gives you hope? What keeps you from devolving when I find myself increasingly being that person? Kid, get off my lawn. What is it that gives you hope?
When I stepped down as president in 2018, I went back into the classroom, and I had not been teaching for however many years, and I had heard all kinds of things about how students were going to censor each other, and they were going to be intolerant, and they weren't going to read anything, and they weren't going to engage with one another. And I don't know if I just got a special group of students or if they decided they'd behave for me because I was the ex-president, but I found exactly the opposite to be true. I found that they had tremendous respect for one another. They wanted to argue. They differed with zeal and honesty and no recriminations. I really never had one inkling of these kinds of... I never needed to tell them to get off my lawn. And so that was uplifting for me. But even more uplifting, perhaps, is they knew what a pickle we're in. And they knew that they had inherited, were inheriting, a world with almost unfathomable problems. And they, all of them, felt that whatever they did, it had to somehow address that. Now, I suppose some of this could have been lip service, and some of it they just sort of thought, well, I'll say it, I don't know that if I'll do it. And time will tell. But when I graduated from college, I think a lot of us felt very intense about the world around us in 1968.
Freedom Summer. When you graduated high school, Freedom Summer. And your participation in Freedom Summer at the time.
It seemed like everything mattered. And I think students in college right now know that everything matters in something of the same way. Mm-hmm. When I first became president of Harvard, student activism, which was in 2007, student activism was very quiet, if existed at all. And it began to rev up in 2011. And I kind of liked it, even though they were picketing me. I thought... good. They've, and besides which, I was a better strategist than they were because I'd had a lot of experience. So I kind of outflanked them on a number of matters early on. But I welcomed that resurgence of commitment and engagement that represented. And so I think we have to, there's a lot that's disturbing that we can see in universities right now, and a lot of disturbing things happening in the aftermath of last weekend's tragic, tragic events as people are trying to figure out how to respond to that and what side of the political spectrum they're on and what that means about how they position themselves. But first of all, they're young, and they're trying out their political wings. They're trying out their ways of being engaged. And I have a lot of hope for where it's going to take us. Do you feel that way? Or
I absolutely do feel that way. And I also need some more advice from you about how to deal with this kind of cognitive dissonance, being the one that used to participate in the protests, and now you find yourself in the seat of the president, right? And so some days I feel like I just want to go outside and stand outside my window with a microphone and yell at myself, right? But it's also a sense of empathy where you can identify with young people.
Yeah.
You can identify with their pains, their hopes, their aspirations, their frustrations.
Okay. But you know something, Jonathan, you and I, not me anymore, but you, especially beginning right now as we elevate you on Friday, represent institutions.
Yes.
And that's different from being a protester out on the other side of the window. And institutions are extremely important in this society. It's institutions that saved my life, in a sense, the educational institutions that welcomed me and gave me a path forward. I think there's an awful lot of anti-institutionalism in our world right now, but we need those institutions. But defending institutions can be very difficult because you can't just go off on every tangent and embrace every good cause. You have to figure out how does doing the right thing fit in with this larger framework of the values and needs of an institution over time. And I don't say that to say, you know, sell out. I don't mean that. I think ultimately we need to preserve these organizations. And so that's why you're on the inside. Good luck with that, John.
No, it is true. I mean, it's so true that so many, particularly young people today, that they don't trust institutions. Many of them have good reasons why, right? And also, and then insofar as they take advantage of institutions, as institutions become not formative spaces, but performative spaces, right? Spaces to enhance one's brand, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. But we cannot underestimate the formative role that institutions and the ways big and small that they facilitate positive and productive change and even protect those of us who are calling for change. I'm actually going somewhere with this because I'm thinking about a story of when you were involved in the civil rights movement and you had, and it was an institution in Atlanta, my alma mater, Morehouse College, that you found refuge one night.
So when I decided that I was going to Selma after seeing John Lewis have his head bashed in, I organized my boyfriend, borrowed a car, and off we went to drive to Selma. And we drove through Atlanta, and after however many hours it took us to get to Atlanta, we were both completely exhausted and thought, we have to find a place to sleep. And we knew we couldn't check into a motel. First of all, I was underage. Secondly, a car with Ohio license plates was not going to be very welcome with young people in it looking like they were going to Selma. And I'd been working in the South with Quaker groups the preceding summer, and I knew my way around Atlanta just a little bit. And in particular, I'd been at this group of colleges that are a very distinguished part of Atlanta's history, black colleges.
Atlanta University Center.
Yep, Atlanta University Center. Mm-hmm. And so I found my way to Morehouse College, which is an African-American all-men's college that Jonathan many, 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 many years later attended. And I drove into the parking lot. We drove into the parking lot there and thought, we can just sleep in the car in the parking lot. We'll be safe. And the security, after about an hour and a half or so, the security guard came over and banged on the window and wanted to know what we were doing sleeping in the parking lot. We said, we're going to Selma. He said, bless you. And off he went. So that was kind of great. Thank you, Morehouse.
There's an epigraph at the outset of your prologue from James Baldwin. It reads, the past will remain horrible for exactly as long as we refuse to see it. You and I discuss what I find so beautiful and wonderful about James Baldwin's writing is the way that he always begins with the self. He lays himself on a kind of operating table of introspection. And it's through identifying and tapping into himself that he's able to actually connect with pains, problems, perils, perplexities of the human condition. There's a strong element of this in your book, particularly in dealing with relationship with your own mother. I was wondering if you could discuss and share some of that
sure.
with us.
First of all, thank you for comparing me to James Baldwin. That may be the high point of my life. He has a way with words that there are two of the epigraphs in the book, they're from him. And I think there would have been like eight from him if my editor had said, how about some other epigraphs here? He has such eloquence and such insight. My mother, the book begins with my mother's death at the age of 48. She was, I believe, a very unhappy person, had a very unfulfilled life, did not know how to fit her means of fulfillment within what was expected of her as a wife and a mother and a lady. And I was aware at a very young age of how unhappy she was. However, that did not prevent me from fighting with her constantly. We had battles from the time I was 2 years old because she, for however much she was frustrated by the world in which she found herself, she tried to prepare me for it and fit me into it. And one of the phrases she often used with me was, it's a man's world, sweetie, and the sooner you figure that out, the happier you'll be. very indicative, I think, both of the reality she thought I faced, but also the anger. There was a tone of anger about the way she said that, and that was clear to me. She died, in some sense, suddenly. I mean, she was much iller than we all around her recognized. We should have recognized it more, but we didn't. And so one day she was getting ready for Christmas. Very soon thereafter, on Christmas Eve, she was dead. We never resolved. We'd had a giant fight the week before about whether I was going to go see a boy whose parents had not written her an appropriate letter of invitation before I came home from college. I told her she was living in the dark ages. This is crazy. I went to see the boy anyway. Then I came home. There was no fight in her. And so we never resolved any of this. We ended our relationship as an argument rather than a relationship. And so writing this book was in some ways for me a way of going back to trying to find a narrative of explanation, a narrative of coherence, of not resolution, nothing so brave or bold as resolution, but at least an approach to what that relationship had been and what it meant. And one of the extraordinary things for me has been how many people I've heard from in the 6 weeks since this book was published about their own relationships with their mothers, and particularly people of my generation. I think that there were some structural changes that happened between what my mother could expect in her life and what we began to be able to hope for and push towards and ultimately grasp in the way of opportunities that got us outside of some of these constraints that my mother was so imprisoned by. The sexual revolution was another reason for a huge gap between my mother's generation and mine, and many reasons, I think, for mothers and daughters to be at odds in that particular time. So most of these letters about mothers have come from people in their 50s, 60s, 70s. But nevertheless, there have been some from younger people as well. And so the whole question of mothers and daughters is a fraught one still, I think, and one that this book delves into to a considerable degree. Maybe you have some wisdom about this.
Well, I heard and I caught that you said that the gender constraints that your mother was imprisoned by, mm-hmm. right? The way that you framed it in that way. Yep. Because one of the things that's clear that comes through in the book is that there were areas where she would concede to patriarchy and gender oppression. Mm-hmm. But there were also many areas where she had a whole lot of fight in her.
Yeah.
And made a lot of good trouble necessary
yes.
trouble. So she was really, really complicated relationship yes. to patriarchy.
Yes. She was a very strong person in lots of ways and had very strong ideas, which is why I had to fight with her all the time. You know, she didn't give up. And I think that feistiness, someone asked me a few weeks ago, you know, what do I admire about my mother? Mm-hmm. And she was extremely ethical. You know, she said, you have to do the right thing, and here's the right thing, and you've got to care about other people, and you have to do these things. And there was just no question about it, and that was priority for her. And that was a very important influence. And then the idea that you fight. And even though she was saying, be a lady, wear all this lace, she didn't want men opening doors for her. She didn't want them carrying her packages. She was going to do it herself.
Would you be open to taking some questions from the audience?
Of course. So I will confess, I had COVID last week, and I'm beyond the CDC guidelines. I'm safe, but I think I've still got some of this going on. But thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I certainly, having grown up in the South myself, admired your career and what you've had to say throughout. It's very inspirational. I wanted to ask you if your journey, your conversion when you were a young person, when you became aware of the outside world, was a solitary journey, or did you have contemporaries that you could talk to, or particularly your brothers, for example?
It was pretty solitary until I got to Concord Academy. My brothers were not interested in these issues, and they are now. I was telling Jonathan about some of the stuff that my older brother in particular is doing in regard to race in Virginia, where he still lives. But I was pretty alone in this. I had a kind of crazy aunt who lived far away. She'd fled the family, and every once in a while I'd go and visit her, and she was great, but that was a rare occurrence. So until I got out of Virginia, I was pretty without companions on this. And that was another great thing about Concord, is that there were a lot of people there who I could share my concerns with.
So I have two questions for you. The first is, how did your folks choose Concord Academy? It's a pretty straight up New England place. How did you not end up in a Southern school or a different institution? So I'd love you to talk about that. And the other question I'd like to ask is, as a college president, I would imagine, particularly in your donor class, had to deal with some people who might not share values you shared. And how do you navigate that when your role is so critical to the institution?
I would love the answer to that question. Thank you.
So the question is just, how do you navigate the donor class? Is that... So I got to Concord. My family, brothers, cousins went away to school. So my mother was kind of in charge of the children's education. And we went on a tour of different schools and looked at some schools in the South, but looked at schools in New England too. And my mother, and I write about this in the book, my mother really did not like living in the South and was very critical about it and kind of thought that there was no real education for children outside of New England. She had these prejudices, having grown up in New Jersey and looking northward to the traditions of education. And so when I fell in love with Concord Academy on a tour, she was very happy to support my going there. And the reason I fell in love with it was it seemed so unpretentious and unstrict at a time when I really didn't want to be put in a nunnery and locked up. And one of the symbols of this for me was when I was visiting, I learned that if you were late for anything, you had to saw a piece of wood. That was your punishment. And I thought that was wonderful. It just, there was a kind of humor about it. You know, it wasn't the end of the world if you were late, but it was enough of a pain in the neck to saw a piece of wood that you'd probably not be late again. And that just seemed the right attitude towards student discipline. And so I was captivated by that. I don't think they do it anymore, unfortunately. But I found that really winning. And it was a great choice for me. Donors. What I found with donors was I never talked about politics with them. I talked about what kind of the level above, you know, the values they had, what they hoped to do with philanthropy, why they were interested in Harvard. And most of the people that I got to see were people who were known to be generous and who cared about higher education and so were likely. I didn't get the non-likelies. I got the likelies to kind of settle the deal or increase the deal or whatever it might be. And a lot of these people were just very admirable. You know, they'd done interesting things, and I saw people who wanted to give their money away, not people who wanted to spend it all on themselves. And so that was nice. That was nice, too. So I, with almost no exceptions, found donors interesting, and I spent time with them with not a great deal of pain and often a great deal of pleasure. So
that's wonderful.
It was okay.
My question was going to be about how you got to Concord, and you answered that. But since I have the microphone, you're talking about how you deal with donors and I suppose also with parents and the general community. And you talk about what you see as the role of leadership in a position like president of Harvard in guiding students to engage in the world?
It's a question about leadership in general, I think. And for me, leadership has always been about trying to figure out where people are, listening to them so that you can begin to see through their eyes where they find themselves. Because if you understand where they are, then you're better equipped to try to move them to where you would like them to be. And so trying to see their perspective, their priorities, their motivations, and then use that as a bridge to explaining your own and trying to be as compelling in language and action as you can to reinforce that sense of where you think they would best off be. That sounds very hierarchical to say where I think they should be. They can dissent, but I can make my case, and I can make my case best if I've understood them first or done everything I can to understand them first. So that would be my response.
On the dust jacket for the book, Congressman James Clyburn from South Carolina writes in part, "This publication should inspire those of us confronting similar challenges in today's America." When you read that, was that a surprise to you, or was that part of your intention in writing this book?
It was part of my intention, and I was really honored to have Congressman Clyburn endorse the book. The way that came about is that I was sent off to meet with him in Congress early in my presidency when money was being sequestered, and we were going to, back in 2009, there was going to be all this cutting back of, this seems like so long ago given all the problems we've had since, but money was being taken out of support for higher education. So I was going around to see everybody on the relevant committee for sequestration. And he and I started talking, and I realized that he was from around Orangeburg, South Carolina, which is where I had spent time in the summer of 1964 on this Friends Civil Rights Initiative. And so we started going back and forth about Orangeburg and about South Carolina State and the terrible massacre that happened there several years later. And we just had a wonderful time. And he asked me to endorse his memoir, which I did with great pleasure. And then turnaround was fair play. I asked him to endorse mine. So he was really generous and did that. But it all began just by chance about this, out of this discussion about our youthful, we're about the same age, our youthful activism and our time spent in Orangeburg, South Carolina, simultaneously, but not knowing each other. So that's the story on where that came from.
I think perhaps you were born a few generations too late. I could see you as a suffragist, chaining yourself to the railings or something like that, or going on hunger strike. So have you ever been moved to any kind of non-violent protest, like a sit-in or chaining yourself to a railing, or have you been more about talking about things and trying to influence things in that way?
Well, I've done my share of sit-ins and marches and various protests, but one of the things I write about in the book is how in the anti-war movement, I really found it very difficult when the movement began to fracture and a group of people that I had been very close to turned to violence. And someone I was very close to in college joined the Weather Underground and disappeared for a number of years, went underground. In fact, she's coming to visit me on Monday. She reemerged, became a pediatric oncology nurse, and has had an exemplary life. But in 1967 and 68, when parts of the movement became quite violent, I just said, that's not me. I think it's because a lot of my initial engagement in political activism was through the Quakers, and I was very much imbued with those values. So passive resistance, passive protest, et cetera, fine with that, but I wasn't going to go and blow up buildings or blow up myself, as one Bryn Mawr student did. It blew up a building, her father's house in Greenwich Village, and herself building a bomb. So there were plenty of people around me who were doing those things, but that was for me a path I wasn't going to follow.
I'm curious what drew you to write about and really focus on the Civil War and that particular kind of perspective that you had in your books.
So much of my scholarship really derives from what this book describes. My very first intellectual project in graduate school, my dissertation, was about people who defended slavery in the years before the Civil War. And I think that was motivated by growing up in a community that bewildered me. How did all these people that I cared about and loved accept, defend segregation? And what does it take to convince yourself that you're going to get up in the morning and live in a society that's unjust? That's a question that continues to interest me and powerfully influence how I look at the world. What are we doing right now that our great-grandchildren are going to think is horrifying? How did people justify what they have justified in the past? The Civil War interest was one that grew in part out of my teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, where I taught for 25 years. And I taught a big survey of Southern history that began with English settlement in 1607 and went to the present. And the Civil War was sort of over Christmas vacation because I didn't really want to talk about the Civil War. But then I began to do more and more and more and get more and more interested in it. And, of course, that had been a theme of my childhood because I lived in the middle of Civil War country and we played Civil War when I was a child. But I think it was also influenced by my concern about the Vietnam War and what war does to societies and the tragedy of war, the pity of war. That's very much at the heart of my interest in the Civil War, and I think it does come out of the Vietnam stuff as well as my concern about race and change.
Mm-hmm. The gentleman in the back and woman in the front here, if you could ask your question, we'll take them together because this was supposed to be the last one, but I saw the two of you and I want...
As you said, you lived in Philadelphia for 25 years while you were teaching at Penn. I just want to know what you miss about our city and welcome back.
Thank you.
What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court's recent decision in affirmative action involving Harvard?
Those are two quite different questions.
Two quite different questions.
So on the Supreme Court's decision involving Harvard, I was very involved in defending Harvard against that lawsuit. It happened during my presidency. I went to the oral argument. I testified in the district court. I went to the oral arguments at the Supreme Court last Halloween, and I wrote a piece for The Atlantic about being at the oral arguments in anticipation that the decision would be what it turned out to be. I think it's a tragedy. I think the notion of colorblindness is completely misguided. We're not a colorblind society. How are we supposed to have a colorblind education system without doing huge damage to what has changed in higher education since I was in college? I also think, as I listened to the oral arguments, they were all over the place, and the decision is all over the place. I thought there might be different positions taken by different of the conservative justices, but I believe the Chief Justice wanted a single denunciation of affirmative action, so I don't know this, but I'm guessing he corralled them all into one incoherent opinion, where, for example, the military academies can practice affirmative action because it's so important to have a diverse military, but apparently nothing else matters, like diverse law or medicine or business, that doesn't matter. So Edward Blum is now suing to have that removed as a provision. So if you really want to know more about what I think, I turn you to The Atlantic Online. It's called The Blindness of Colorblindness, but I was very distressed and remain distressed about this decision and its implications for higher education and American society more generally. And what do I miss about Philadelphia? It's great to be back. One of the things I was really missing tonight as I walked here down the parkway is my daughter, who's now, can't believe it, 41, who grew up here in Philadelphia, played sports with the Fairmont League as a kid. And I just remember she was a great softball player, and these glory days of her Fairmont softball team. The very first game she played, kids were 8 years old, and one of the kids on her team didn't understand that you could throw the ball to third base. She thought she had to, this was not my daughter, this was another one, had she chased the other little girl all the way around the bases. She thought she had to catch up with her in order to put her out. So from some sort of baseball babyhood to teenage Fairmont League, I loved that, and I was very nostalgic about it tonight. And on a night, I should say, I miss the Phillies. I miss the Phillies. I was a big fan in the early 90s, and I can still talk about the team of Mickey Morandini and Darren Dalton and all the rest of them if we can really go back and remember a long time ago. Thanks, all of you, so much for coming. And
my friends.
Thank you to Jonathan.
Drew Gilpin Faust, Necessary Trouble.
President Walton.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.